Thank you very much. That was a very moving introduction. Interestingly, in the Brooks Myers thing, I'm thinking rather than feeling, but there you go. I don't think there's any contradiction there. Anyway, as Ridge Matty said, I've got a cold, by the way. My throat's a bit sore, so bear with me if I sound a bit croaky. I have been ordained quite a long time. I've been ordained 23 years. But there is somebody who's not here this morning, unfortunately, because I wanted to say, but I'll say it anyway, although she isn't here, who's been ordained quite a long time longer than myself, one of the very few Dharmacharinis that was around when I got involved. That's Marichi, who in fact is celebrating tomorrow her 30th anniversary in the order. So I thought I'd mention that. She and Damodena were ordained, tomorrow's Banti's birthday, and they were ordained on Banti's birthday 30 years ago. So I wanted to rejoice actually in both of them, rejoice a bit in the fact that the order would be a different place if those women and women of their generation hadn't, you know, carried on occasionally, or quite often, through things that weren't always that easy. So just rejoice in Marichi's tenacity and positivity and good humour. Actually, she's been a very good friend to me, although recently we don't have so much, you know, to do with each other, though we're kind of related by marriage, you know. So all Glaswegians are related, so, you know, Danavera and I are kind of karmically bonded in some ways, which I might talk about in the course of the talk or not. And so Marit, she's like my sister-in-law, sort of, you know. But I am very fond of Marit, and she has been a great friend to me, and particularly in my early days, she was somebody who was incredibly supportive of me coming into a very strange order movement, full of very strange people who went to bed at 9 o'clock. At night, that is. Whereas I tended to go to bed nearer 9 o'clock in the morning, quite often. And she was somebody who was very urbane and very kind of, you know, you could talk to Marichi about virtually anything, and she listened to Radio 4 and knew all sorts of things, but all sorts of interesting things. So, you know, she's a great resource, Marichi, and I sometimes think a slightly underused resource, because she doesn't sell herself, because she's not from Glasgow. And, you know, just maybe when you see her, just go up and say happy birthday, and, you know, if you feel it, express your appreciation of her. Okay, so I thought I'd mention that. So I'm giving a talk apparently called How to Be an Individual Within Collective Practice, which sounds great, but let me just say at the beginning that I have no idea. And this is not a talk that gives answers, okay? This partly grew out of a 10-minute presentation that I gave in the Women's Convention, which Maitra Devi particularly said to me afterwards she'd enjoyed, and she thought it could be useful as the basis of a talk, given that I was coming here to give a talk. So I thought, that's good. I'll just don't need to think any more about that then. And then last night at midnight, I started to think a bit about it. And basically, I'm just going to give the same presentation with a few added bits, okay? And it might touch on the topic of individuality. But basically what I want to do is open up and ask questions rather than specifically giving my take on what it is to be an individual or how to practice within a collective. Yeah, because I think it's actually a very exciting, quite challenging question really, isn't it? And I think it's relevant for virtually everybody who's involved in any kind of collective practice. And therefore, presumably, quite relevant to people here who are involved in collective work as a collective practice, as well as being members of the order or prospective members of the order or thinking about being members of the order, which is also in itself a collective practice. So, as Ridge Matty said in his introduction, we're in a process of change at the moment. And it is a really quite interesting point that we're in the order and the movement, I think. I was glad you said what you said about it now being the first time that we've been there. In fact, the order members here might have read Aloka's article in this month's article, Shabda. And it's very interesting because, I mean, it's brilliant actually anyway, but there's a bit in it where he says the movement was being reorganised every day. It was being revisioned every day. In every seminar that Banti gave, in every talk that Banti gave, in every lunchtime conversation with Banti, the movement was being reformed. Well, that would have been around 74, 75 that he's talking about. I got involved in 77, 78. So things were a bit more formed than they were in 77, but not actually very much. So And I think it was very obvious that the edifice was not solid. I think it was very obvious in a way that we were making it up as we went along. Well, I suspect that is still the case, actually. And most of us are still making it up as we go along, to some extent, although with a lot more experience behind us. But I think it's worth remembering that actually things aren't as solid as they appear to be. Nothing is as solid as they appear to be. Actually, that's basic Buddhism anyway. But the order, the movement, the fact that it is in a process of change, I think is bringing something out into the open which is there anyway and which has to be there anyway. Having said that, I think it's a very interesting, exciting, challenging moment. And I do feel a little bit for people who have just been ordained or who are about to get ordained. You know, you are coming into the order in a very specific moment. But then every moment's specific. And, you know, you can, in another way, it's quite interesting to feel that you can be part of something which is revisioning itself. I think that's just fascinating. I love the Western Buddhist order. You know, I love it, I love it, love it. I really love the fact that we're trying to analyse something as we're doing it, and that we're actually willing to look at what that means, and we're actually willing to look back. And I think, you know, to a great extent, acknowledge mistakes and acknowledge wrong turnings. Because I think if we don't do that, there's no way forward, really. Anyway, obviously does also raise big questions. And I have to confess that sometimes I feel a bit defensive at the moment. I'll confess that. I sometimes feel a little bit like things that I hold very dear and have held very dear are being challenged in a not always very kind of sympathetic way. And I sometimes think, you know, we look back and there's all sorts of talk and shabda at the moment and in the air at the moment about things, you know, people who've been harsh in the past and have done this and have done that. And I'm sure I've been one of those people at times. I've certainly felt I've suffered from harshness, and I'm sure I've been harsh because I am quite harsh. I've got quite a critical faculty, and sometimes I'm brusque. Brusque, is that an English word? Yeah. Thank you. And I've got Chandra Dasa here, actually. He's very good. He can help me out when my English gets bad. Because I don't speak English as well as I used to before I went to Spain. Yeah, I'm sure I have been at times, but I was thinking the other day, when you look back, how easy it is to read mistakes through current knowledge. And actually, the mistakes weren't made with current knowledge, if you see what I mean. Which is not to say that mistakes and harshnesses and things shouldn't be acknowledged. I think they must be acknowledged. But I think it's important also to acknowledge that the person who made those mistakes is not the person who's currently acknowledging those mistakes. Because I think it's very easy for me, for example, to look at certain order members and think, how could he, usually he, but it could be she, I suppose, you know, how could that person have done that thing? But it's because, in a way, I'm looking at that person in the year 2003, probably with 20-odd years of practice behind them, and it's most probable that that person wouldn't have done or said that particular thing, but that wasn't the person who did or said it. Anyway, that's something I've been thinking a bit about in the current kind of climate of acknowledgement and, you know, speaking out. But I have to say as well that I do sometimes feel a bit, things that I've held dear and hold dear might get thrown out as well in the turmoil. And actually, when I'm feeling okay, I don't feel that, because I kind of feel quite confident, actually, in the future of the order. And I feel quite confident that the things that I hold dear are in line enough with the things that other people hold dear, not to end up feeling that I can't, you know, that it isn't going to be the order that I joined or that's helpful for me at core. So I thought what I'd do, actually, is just talk a little bit about some of my thoughts, really, given this particular climate, and specifically how collectivity features in that and how important I feel it is as a practice. Yeah. So as my history was a little bit revealed to you in the introduction, but it's true that I came into the movement at a very particular time and from a very particular background. Yeah. And I was attracted by what I understood as the kind of radical edge of the Western Buddhist Order and the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. I had done a little bit of exploration. I'd read the Buddhist Society's booklets on the Noble Eightfold Path, which I thought were quite interesting. I'd met a couple of English Buddhists that I thought were remarkably uninteresting. And I'd kind of, I'd heard a little bit about impermanence, and I'd read the Tibetan Book of the Dead while on acid, which was very helpful, which had a great transformative experience on me, which lasted for about 24 hours, which was the problem with acid. So I kind of thought I knew a bit about Buddhism. And then I came across some lectures by Sangharakshita, and really that just kind of blew it open for me. So I was quite attracted by the fact that there was what seemed to me to be a strong critique of the dominant culture that we lived in at that time. So that was the late 70s. And I was very attracted by the fact that certain institutions were critiqued. And in a way that fitted in quite well with my own kind of, take on society. There were certain things I knew I didn't want to participate in. And there were certain things that, I thought was were kind of evil, like capitalism, for example. I still think that a bit. Not totally. I've been converted now. I'm a kind of soft, open, free economy sort of a communist. Anyway, so I was attracted by the critique of the dominant culture. And I was attracted by all the talk of the new society. And I was attracted by the people that I heard talking about that, which were mainly Dhanavira, Dhammarati, Ajita, who some of you might would have known. And I went along to the Glasgow Centre at a very particular kind of period, and it was very, we used to go up mountains and chant Padmasambhava mantras all night and in the, in the rain and the wind, and then we'd spend a week recovering, and then... And I heard lectures about all sorts of things to do with collectivity, and they really, really, really caught me and inspired me. And we tried to set up a co-op in Glasgow, which failed dismally, but we tried. We did try. And we used to go down the pub in Byers Road to talk about this quite a lot. And we had some very good conversations after classes in the pubs in Byers Road. And, the Western Buddhist Order in Glasgow was forged in pubs in Byers Road, which says a lot. Anyway, I think, thinking about how times have changed and, whether the situation that we're currently living in, how similar it is or how different it is to the situation that I got involved in, particular kind of moment historically, and a particular place geographically, which also had its, had its flavour. And one of the questions that comes to my mind is there a single dominant culture to critique? I don't think there is in the same way anymore. I think it was much easier in the mid-70s to have a critique of a dominant culture. And these days things are so pluralistic, which I think has got good and bad elements to it, that it's actually very difficult to find where do you find the cutting edge of critiquing the dominant culture? It's almost like there's such a plurality of dominant cultures, which I think at times we've attacked just as a thing. The fact that there's a plurality of dominant cultures we've also critiqued, not very skillfully to my mind most of the time, because I don't think there's been quite enough knowledge about the diversity of those dominant cultures. But what I came up with when I was thinking about this is that although dominant cultures are perhaps less easy to critique, you can still critique samsara, and that maybe in a way that's the base, that's the root. Maybe we shouldn't be too worried, in a sense, about the particular conditions and circumstances that we're living in and that we're trying to critique, because samsara will always be there to be critiqued. And really that's what we should be critiquing in a way, rather than the specifics, perhaps, of how samsara plays itself out. We can critique all sorts of parts of that, but maybe the truly kind of exciting thing is to see a critique of samsara. So we're obviously in a different phase at the moment. We're in the 21st century rather than the 20th century. Things have maybe changed even more than we realise they've changed. There are all sorts of changes that I think in society that you can only really see in hindsight. So we live in them, and we're trying to be part of them, and we're trying to work within them without really having much of an overview of what they are. But nevertheless, I think we can still critique, as I say, samsara, we can still critique greed, hatred and delusion in its many and multitudinous forms. So when I first got involved, the forum that critique took, not so much the critique, but the solution to the critique, or the opposition to the critique, took the form of the three C's. Remember the three C's. You know, communities, co-ops and centres. And I really liked the three C's. So there were ways of living together, working together, and creating the conditions together for teaching the Dharma. So that all of them had as their kind of basis, or part of their existence, was to do with collectivity. And in the early days, it was actually quite easy to experience yourself as part of a collective. I was remembering when we went, the women order members, the Dharmacharinis, all went to the Isle of Muck in Scotland in, it was probably 80s, yeah, my God, I'm so old. I know some of you were only toddlers at school and things like that, yeah. Which is very good, because we need young people, you know, that wonderful concept, young people, marvellous things. Actually, I hate it when people say, oh, you've been doing 23 years, really? I was only three when you got ordained. I say, that's marvellous, that's lovely, thank you for sharing that with me. But it is good, isn't it, actually? Because we don't really want an order full of old fogies that are going to have to be supported into their old dodder in old age, do we? We need some young people to do that, don't we? That's the thing. Because you see, I haven't had children, so you are my children. Don't call me mummy. Anyway. So yeah, it was quite easy. We all went off to Muck in the early 80s. And all the Dharmacharinis in the UK went to the island of Muck in the west of Scotland. Muck actually means the island of dolphins, by the way. It doesn't mean muck as in grubbiness. It means the Isle of the Dolphins. It's very beautiful. And there were 19 of us. And that was it. That was all the women order members in the whole of the UK. So if the boat had sunk on the way back, we'd have been, you know, left Dharmacharini-less. But fortunately it didn't, although many people were very seasick. And the rest of us got through it by playing charades on the boat, which was very funny. Anyway, that was quite amazing that we could sit in a room. The whole of the women's wing of the Western Buddhist Order could sit in a room together. And we all knew each other incredibly well, you know, and I still feel very, very strong links with the people that were ordained at that time. It's obviously not so easy to feel that anymore. You know, there are over 1,000 order members, there's 1,100 and something order members, I think, something like that. It's just gone over 1,100, I think. It's not so easy to feel that you're part of something where you know everybody. Although, for me, I still do, in fact, feel a link. We're all and every member of the Western Buddhist Order, which is strange, but it's true. So we are obviously in a different kind of phase. And also, you know, we used to have order weekends when I was first ordained at Padmasuri. I remember this. Our order weekends were mixed, and we had them all in the London Buddhist Centre reception room. And we'd all be sitting in there with about 60, 65 people or something, and we'd listen to everybody reporting in. And at that time, Shabda actually consisted of the handwritten reports of what those people had said in that reporting in. So that when I was first ordained, somebody would scribe, somebody would write down what each person was saying, and then they'd type it up and send it to, I think it was Ananda at that point, who compiled Shabda. And so Shabda, in fact, was nothing more or less than the kind of typed up reports of what people had said at that order weekend. And that was, I mean, it was a very different feeling, actually, because you heard everybody, you kind of, you know, you watched them crying and laughing and using the same hand gestures if they all came from the same centre. It's very funny, actually. It's true. There were particular hand gestures that you could associate. You could tell which centres people were from quite often, you know. The people who always rejoiced really, really strongly in people's merits. And I won't tell you what centre they were from. And then there were other people who all came down in a bus from Glasgow, and they would report in, and the only other people that ever understood them were other Glaswegians. So do you remember Uthra? He'd report and he'd go, oh, blah, 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 and the glass of Egypt would go, oh, and everybody else would go, huh? Very good. And I remember on one occasion he had this painted Padmasambhava rupa that somebody had given, I think Chintamani had painted for him, and he held it up and he gave this amazing little discourse in Padmasambhava, which four of us understood. And we spent the next 10 minutes telling people what he'd said, by which point, you know, he'd kind of lost it completely. But anyway, those were the good old, bad old days. So we are in a very different phase, but as I say, we are still in the same old samsara. And I assume that we have still got, to a great extent, the same shared values. So though I think, you know, the times are quite different, and I think we're working in a kind of different way, and the institutions that we've set up, I mean, in those days it was very easy to see how those institutions could serve your practice, because we were creating them out of the basis of practice, or out of the basis of intense practice. I mean, I'd have to say the practice that most of us had was more enthusiasm than depth. But nevertheless, there was enthusiasm, and we looked for institutions, for want of a better word, and structures and things that would back up and support the kind of practice that we wanted to have. And a collective practice was quite a strong part of that. There was a lot of emphasis on how important it was to kind of carry the retreat situation into your daily life, or how to set up ways of working together so that you maximised your practice by being with other Buddhists. And I sometimes wonder if we haven't got to a point where the institutions, rather than serving the practice, are sometimes, they seem to almost have an independent identity. And I think it's very important to recognise that, and to really find the ways of looking at our institutions, our work-based situations, our communities, whatever, and really see how they're supporting our individual practice. Because if they're not supporting our individual practice, then something isn't working. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the institutions are at fault, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not capable of being in them. It just means that something isn't marrying, and that that needs to be looked at. So I think it's probably safe to say that we're all Buddhists. That's probably safe, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, if you know it, don't worry, that's fine, because we're in this new open phase, you know, taking Buddhism out of Buddhism, you know, that sort of thing. But I think it is true to say that we are all Buddhists, and that we all have got a critique of samsara, and that we're all into, in that case, renunciation. That would be safe to say, wouldn't it? That we're all into renunciation. If you're not into renunciation... Oh, sorry, that's... I've forgotten my NVC training there for a minute. That I've not done very much, but I'll try and bear it in mind. Actually, do you know, when I hear people talking to me in an NBC sort of a way, can I just say something here? Don't take this personally, why I get it, because I'm not thinking of you, actually, especially. I mean, when people are skilled at it, it's fantastic, but you know that phase where people are just learning and they kind of go very sort of wooden and a bit, you know, buttock clenched, as they sort of tell you? I get this great urge to say, when you speak to me like this, I feel a great need to say... Of course, I don't do it. I don't do it, of course, because I'm working on my ethics, you know. And that is by way of a confession, although it doesn't sound like a confession, does it? Okay, my confession is that I'd like that to be a confession, but I'm not quite there yet. Okay, that'll do, will it? I think NVC is very good, by the way. Anyway, as I was saying before I was interrupted by myself, we are all into renunciation. But let's be clear, what we're renouncing is the ego. No, you know, we're not necessarily renouncing any specific way of dealing with that, but we are at heart trying to go beyond the self. I mean, if you're not wanting to go beyond the self, why bother being a Buddhist? Because it's, you know, it's hard work, I think. So I think we are trying to go beyond ourselves. Okay, so beyond personal preference, let's say. And I think what I was thinking about with this whole new kind of opening up the order and things and the movement, which I think is very good, honestly, I do think it's very good. I do, believe me, please. But I do, you know, I get worried that we don't just end up opening things up so much that there's nothing to hold on to, you know. And I really think it's great what's happening. I think it's really good. I'm right behind it. And I have faith that it'll be all right. But I'm a bit sort of nervous of the in-between stages, I suppose. And you have to, I mean, I can see you just have to sit with that and be with that. Being nervous is all right, you know. But I sometimes, you know, worry that we go too far down a particular road and we throw the baby with the bathwater, you know, to use that expression. I do think we will. I wrote to Sabuti a while back saying, I'm a bit fed up with all this now. Can we finish this opened up bit now? I've done that. And it wasn't quite like that. But I think just some of the things that I'd read in Shabden, some of the things that people had said to me personally, I sort of thought, well, okay, you know, that's good. But can we have a life, please? You know, can we just get on with things a bit? And he wrote back to me quite strongly saying, you know, we really must not close down this process prematurely. We really must allow people to have the space to express things. And we just must have faith that this phase is okay. And that he said, and I have complete faith that we have enough of the transcendent within the order, within, you know, what we're doing, for it to be okay in the long run. And it quite struck me, actually. I thought, I do at heart believe that, but being an impatient sort of a person, I don't always find it very easy to sit with the process, you know. I think that's something I've had to learn over the years, and it's something that I've learned from particularly people. Attila, I'd say I've learned an awful lot from in that sense of just sitting with process. And just noticing what you're feeling within it and working with that, dealing with that, and not necessarily acting on it or not necessarily believing that what you're feeling is a basis for kind of future anything really. So just trying to sort of sit with all that, I've just been trying to think a bit about what I believe really to be the heart of the matter, if you like. What is it that we're trying to come out with in this particular phase in the movement's history? On the order's history. And I think what I've been coming up with, what I've been thinking about is like, well, what is true spiritual practice? Now, obviously, everybody will have a slightly different answer for that, and that says it must be. But I'm thinking that true spiritual practice can never just be on our own terms, but neither can it really ever be on somebody else's terms. So that leaves us in quite a rocky place, really, in a sense. I think if we try to have a spiritual practice based on our own terms, well, in a way where there's no true transformation of the ego possible, yeah, we would end up only with a negative domination of self-view and self-ego, which as Buddhists, I think we would all agree is not the path that we're trying to tread. We're not actually trying to tread the path of deepening and strengthening the ego. We're actually trying to work against the ego's fetters and what actually binds us to samsara. We're trying to actually find freedom from that. So if we try to find freedom from something using its own, you know, its own terms or its own self as a road to freedom, I think we're stuck. I think that isn't, you know, you can't really look for freedom from the ego by imposing your ego. Yeah. So we can't really have a spiritual life only in our own terms. However, if we live our spiritual life in somebody else's terms, we just end up with a negative submission of ego. So neither have we actually really transformed the ego. So if we look for validation for our practice, if I think, well, how do I test if my practice is working? And I only test it through my own feelings or through the filter of my own consciousness. There's also a danger in that because, again, I'm using the very apparatus that I'm trying to break through to validate something. So I think if we look for validation only from self-experience, we're in trouble. However, if I take my validation only from an external authority, I'm also in trouble. If my validation comes from a series of externals that I fit myself into, then I'm stuck as well. There's no free flow of energy, if that's the case. So somehow personal responsibility needs a bigger forum in which to test itself. And that bigger forum, for me, is when we start to move into the whole arena of collective practice. And for me, that's the heart of my practice as a Buddhist within this particular order, is finding a way of personally taking responsibility for my own practice, for my own needs, for my own abilities and weaknesses and strengths, knowing myself enough to know what I need to do, but at the same time, experiencing that within something bigger than just myself. It seems to me for the order to have a future, the heartbeat of individual practice needs to be in tune with the heartbeat of the collective. You know, if there isn't a concordance between those two things, and there won't always or maybe ever be a perfect concordance between those two elements, it might well be that there's a constant adjustment. You know, it's a bit like when you fly from London to New York. You don't get in the plane and go in a straight line to New York. What's actually happening all the time is that the automatic pilot is correcting the trajectory, otherwise you wouldn't get there. It takes into account all the different factors that are happening. So a plane journey actually from A to B consists of a lot of little kind of diversions. And that's a bit what it's like leading a spiritual life, isn't it? We have a very clear idea on the whole of where we want to go to. And if our model is that of self-transcendence, self-development, if we're trying to get from A to B, then that moving from A to B is going to be a constant series of adjustments. But it seems to me that the adjustments, to a great extent, need to be in harmony with something bigger than just one's own practice. And for me, that's where the order and where the movement and its institutions come into play. They are practices. They're actually practices for being an individual within a collective. Because in a sense, how do we test ourselves if we don't have something? I read something recently that somebody had written about the order, and she's saying, oh, you know, how different the order would be if only we had developed our meditation practice a lot deeper and we had an order with yogis at its heart. And I thought, well, I wouldn't actually personally be terribly interested in that. Note that I don't think we need people with strong and deep meditation practices. I don't see them as contradictory. But in a sense, I'm part of the Western Buddhist order because it is an order, because it is a collective, because it is something that binds it and glues it together. I'm not personally that interested in just personal practice. I mean, in a way, it's not, I don't have anything against personal practice, don't get me wrong. I do it. I do personal practice. But I do think, for me at least, it's important that that personal practice has a place in something bigger than itself. I think an order of yogis would be fabulous. I probably wouldn't be in it. But that's all right, isn't it? It'd be something else. For me, the order or the collective as a practice is to do with creating the conditions for what Banti's talked about as the third order of consciousness, for the arising of the bodhicitta. Okay, you knew I'd get there in the end. But, I mean, it is really, really important for me. Anyway, I want to have just a little detour at the moment and just draw something on the board, if I may. Excuse me. So what we've got here are two models of an institution, or two models of a movement, or two models of coming together, of collectivity, yeah? And in the first one, the L in the centre stands for leaders, yeah? So you can have an institution which congregates around a leader or leaders, yeah? And to a great extent, that's what we've had. You know, we had that with Banti. We've had that in a sense with the model that Banti's left us, with Banti's legacy. What we've inherited from Banti is very much that model. And that model is also, can also be seen as a triangle or pyramid. In other words, it's a relatively hierarchical model. It's a very hierarchical model. It's a hierarchy based on a spiritual hierarchy, but it's also faded, it's also kind of gone over into being a structural model, where the spiritual hierarchy has, to a great extent, been reflected in the organisational hierarchy. I wonder how sustainable that really is, not only for the order as a whole, but for entities, if you like, within our order and movement. If I think about my own situation in Valencia, I think it's still a bit too much in that kind of model. I think I still carry a bit too much. people might not agree with that in Valencia. Some of them probably wouldn't. Some of them would and not like it, and some of them probably don't ever think about it. But I think my feeling is that I'm still too much at the heart of things in Valencia. And, you know, that's happened for all sorts of reasons. It's happened for historical reasons. It's happened because of who I am, because of, you know, the fact that I've been ordained for a long time. I'm a triple Leo. I can't help that. You know, I'm an extrovert. For all sorts of reasons, I've held a particular position there. And it's been the case in lots of other situations and lots of other institutions, if you like. And it's not a sustainable model. The worst that might happen is that the leader dies. You know, the leader leaves, the leader goes. And what are you left with? You're left with a hole in the middle. And that is not a good model. And the other thing about the top model, is that the little arrows leading in are how we congregate. So if we congregate around a person, it's like the relationships all have to be worked out through that person. Yeah. And the second model has at its centre, at its heart, core values. Yeah. So the second model is a model where the collectivity is given because of a shared core value or shared core values. Now, it might be that the leadership is still given by exactly the same person or people, but the relationship is different. The person is not in that having to carry a particular archetype, which is what I think can sometimes happen in the first of those models. If the archetype that's being carried is being carried lightly and it's actually not being carried but articulated, then I think there's a much more sustainable institution, really. So this is something I've been thinking about quite a lot recently in terms of the order. You know, do we actually have the same core values? Now, I've said that to people and they've said, well, of course we do. We're all going for refuge. And I think, yes. And what does that mean? Exactly. Heidegger says... Wow. Thank you. I did study philosophy, actually, excuse me. Anyway, and actually it wasn't Heidegger, it was Kierkegaard. I get them mixed up. He said, you know, they're sort of similar kind of people, really, aren't they? One man may agree with another word for word and both be guilty of the grossest misinterpretation. Good, so I did that again. One man, and I think it's probably true of women too, I think we're using the term here in its generic sense, may agree with another, word for word, and both be guilty of the grossest misinterpretation. So I can say to you, well, of course my core value is going for refuge, and you say, well, of course my core value is going for refuge, and we think, bingo, we've got a collective. But actually, we might be thinking very different things about what that means. So I think we need to clarify our terms quite strongly and really see whether that means the same thing for each person. And to a great extent, if we think about ordination, the changes that are afoot and that are happening in a way, I think are calling for every order member to really assess what they think they're doing and they're going for refuge. Because in a way, at the moment, the centrality of that and the agreement of that comes from the fact that we've got a core of people, 11 public preceptors, who agree to every single ordination in the world outside of India. And even in India, some of them have quite a strong say. So the last word on who enters the order comes from a relatively small number of people. I'm personally okay with that. But then I know all those people and I know them quite well. I can see that the time, you know, that things are changing and that there is a need for that to be decentralised to some extent, which is what's been suggested. If any of you haven't read the paper in the July Shabda, it's open to order members and mitras, it's not a closed thing, about the restructuring, what's it called? The future something. shaping the future of the order and the movement. I do recommend that you read it, actually, because it's very important. There's some really good, important stuff in there that I think needs to be thought about and looked at and talked about. There is a talk.
Convention talk.
Sabuti's convention talk, yeah. Sabuti also gave a talk at the end of the mixed convention, which fleshed that out and made it more human, I think, rather than just a bit of paper. So I do recommend that people, you know, if you in the order, I think you have a moral responsibility, if I may say so, to think about that, because passivity doesn't work, yeah? It isn't really passivity, it's something else. And if you're thinking of entering the order, then, you know, I would have thought you would be interested in knowing about that. So I do really recommend that people, you know, take it on, think about it and look at it, yeah? So, what was I saying there? Because I've got a bit lost now. That's moving out, isn't it? That kind of responsibility is moving out to some extent. I personally think there's still a need for something that gives centrality, something that means that all order members can trust the going for refuge of all other order members through some kind of shared values. But I think at the same time, all of us have to kind of take responsibility for that and be thinking about that and working with that. So my question at the moment, in a way, is what are our core values? And this brings up quite a few questions. The other thing just says that the bottom model, where you have core values as a centrality, gives rise to a mandala model rather than a pyramid model, because you're not relating in a strictly hierarchical sense. You're relating in the sense of centrality and focus. So some people will articulate and experience and embody those core values more than some other people at any given time. But that's fluid, flexible, and will change. So that, I think, is quite a good model. I mean, it's just one personally that I find quite exciting, and I think it raises questions. So it raises the question, what are my core values? And it raises the question of, where do those core values harmonise with the core values of the collective that I've dedicated my life to? And it raises the question, do they part at some point from the core values of the collective that I've dedicated my life to? And I think it requires courage to ask those questions of oneself. But I think it requires, without that courage, in a way, I'd feel dead. Basically, I wouldn't ask those questions. So for me, in a way, it's very clear. My answer to that's quite clear. For me, my central core value, and it's an abstract term, but I know what I mean by it, is the Bodhisattva ideal. That, for me, is the core value. That it's my North Star. It's what I've guided my ship by for the 25 years that I've been a Buddhist. I hope it's what I'll continue to do that, you know, by. It's the radar that corrects my flight path, which is bumpy, turbulent at times. But I think there is a fairly clear beacon for me in that ideal. And I would argue that that is quite strongly built into what the order is. You know, it might not be articulated exactly in those terms, but right from the very beginning, Bhante has emphasised again and again and again the need for creating the conditions for the arising of the Bodhicharya. The very, very first seminar that Bhante led was in the Bodhicharya Avatara. That was the first seminar. It was the first Buddhist text that he chose to underline and present to us. It's there in the ordination ceremony. I've seen 10 public ordinations this summer, which is fantastic. I love public ordinations, I love them. I think they should all be really, really public. I think we should do away with retreats at Tuscany and retreats in Gokiloka. At least not the retreats, but the ordinations. I think we should, very on NVC. What I mean is, my preference, I would like to see public ordinations public. I love them, they're fantastic. We had 2 at the beginning of the Women's Convention, 2 at the beginning of the Mixed Convention, and there's been 6 in the retreat that I've just been in Tiruvannamalai. And they were fantastic. They hired the village hall. It was great. We all went down to the village hall. And it was all set up in the village hall, and people had invited, you know, friends and family. There were kids there. It was brilliant. And we applauded. I've always liked that when I've seen it in newsreels in India, you know, and they hear your name and everybody. You know, we hear, oh, that's very nice. You know, and this time it was great. And some of you might know Vijayatara, who used to be Chardon, LBC, black woman from the LBC. When she got her case, so the place erupted. It was fantastic. The place just sort of went, yeah! You know, and it just felt really, really good that, you know, people were there, loads of people had come, her partner and her family, and it was great. There was good. I thought, this is, I love public ordinations. And every time you hear them, it just, for me anyway, it puts me right back in touch with why I'm doing what I'm doing. You know, that's what I'm into. That's what I'm interested in. I really went to see people again, not just to put up the numbers, but because I believe that it really is a context that helps, you know, helps the world. Anyway, at the end of the public ordinations, you will remember, if you haven't been to one, you might know this anyway, there are four lines of acceptance, which express the spirit in which we accept our ordination into the Western Buddhist Order. And they're very interesting, actually. So we accept it with loyalty to our teachers, a very interesting concept at this point in our history, and one that should not be forgotten. We accept it with the spirit of attaining enlightenment, also very important. Without that, why bother? So we have individual practice in there. We have relationships that you could call hierarchical in there. We accept to in harmony with our brethren and sisters, and we accept it for the sake of all beings. So in a way, it's all in there in the ordination ceremony, in those four lines. There's hierarchical relationships acknowledged. There's the fact that we're a collective acknowledged. We have brothers and sisters. We have individual practice acknowledged, and we have the fact that actually we do this at the end of the day for the sake of all beings. We don't do it just to practice better. We actually do it for the sake of all beings. So what we have there, in a sense, is the working ground that we're all of us involved in, that we're all of us working in. A coincidence of wills in which the heartbeat of my own core values can march in tune to the heartbeat of the core values of the collective that I've dedicated my life to. And the three C's, in a sense, were the beginning of that. That's why we set up the three C's, was to create conditions that gave you the practical possibility of living together and working together. So there were collectives in a very specific kind of sense. There were collectives where you spent all your working day with somebody and you lived with people. Sometimes they coincided, sometimes not. And if you worked at a centre, you were there very clearly to work with other people to create the conditions for people to learn about Buddhism. Now, I do think that at best they work, and at worst they become something that in fact blocks individuality rather than supports individuality. But I think that is the personal responsibility of everybody participating in a collective. And it's not always easy. It's not always easy to feel that your voice can be heard within a particular collective. So I think there is an imperative to speak, and there is an imperative to listen. You know, the two sides of the same coin, really. And well, I've been thinking that maybe we could revision the three C's. So please indulge me. This is, as I say, I'm just sharing my thoughts with people, but, you know, why not? So I thought that we could have, we used to have communities, didn't we? Communities, centres and co-ops. Actually, for a long time they haven't been co-ops, but they were co-ops when we started, weren't they, Vajrakirti? You remember co-ops, don't you? That's when I got to know Vajrakirti in a way through co-ops. Yes, indeed. And I think, you know, the values that are there in those are still really, really important. And I know in a way I'm preaching to the converted, as it were, because you're all here, because you're all involved in collective practice. But something that I just think, you know, in a way thinking kind of broadly about, I wonder if maybe we could rethink these a little bit, which doesn't necessarily mean that we change what we do, but maybe there are things we can be rethinking within what we do. So I thought, instead of communities, we could just have community. Isn't that nice? That's very interesting. And instead of co-ops, we could have cooperation. Isn't that radical? And instead of centres, we could have congruency. I had to have something that started with C. Because, and what I mean by that is, okay, so with communities, rather than fixing ourselves in a particular kind of lifestyle, and this is happening, you know, there is a broadening out of an acknowledgement of different kinds of lifestyle. And in this little booklet, which I don't know if people are familiar with, it's a great cover, Roads to Freedom. Yeah. Anyway, some talks given by Subbuti recently, which they probably also go as talks, I'm sure, in what isn't always called Dhammachakra tapes, although it isn't actually called Dhammachakra tapes, but never mind. If we say that, we know what we mean. Subbuti does talk in this about realising that rather than thinking of a hierarchy of lifestyles, to just think of a range of lifestyles. Hallelujah. I think that's very important, actually. And it's not to say that some of those lifestyles aren't more supportive than others for some people at particular times in their practice. But, you know, maybe community is a better core value than a structure called communities. So that those of us who choose to live in communities, those of us that choose to live alone, those of us that choose to live with partners, with families, with people, whatever option we choose as a lifestyle, we actually see it as forming part of a community of practitioners with the same core values, rather than just thinking that that means a specific way of life. Co-ops, again, in a sense, I mean, they haven't really been called co-ops for years, but they were when I started, and I liked the fact they were co-ops. We used to be part of the ICOM structure, which was the co-op movement here in the UK, and right in the early 80s, we had quite a lot to do with that. I remember we went to a particular co-op thing run by ICOM, and our publicity said, "We are the opiate of the people." Do you remember that? Something like that, or the opiate of the people comes to Dartington, or something like that. Anyway, I thought it was quite silly that, and I did that. And we kind of had Right Livelihood as quite a kind of political force, really. A force for change, a real force for change. And I think it's fantastic that there are still people who want to work in that kind of way, who want to cooperate with each other in terms of actually a hands-on, day-to-day kind of way of working. I do think there's a really radical option there. I think there are also other ways of being in cooperation, and I think there needs to be quite a broad realisation of what cooperation means. Because cooperation means, to a great extent, putting our strengths to the service of something bigger than ourselves. It doesn't necessarily mean working with our weaknesses, because that's the only thing available to us. You know? Sometimes I think that's what happens, that we end up in a situation where we're not working to our capacity, but we're doing what needs to be done. And I think if we had a broader perspective and ways of working and broader kind of visioning of what cooperation really is, then I think maybe we could come down to being able to happily coexist and work in situations. Not that I don't think we do, but I mean, we can always go further, can't we? And centres, well, what I've put is congruency there, because there's been quite a lot of talk recently about the movement is the altruistic activity of members of the Western Buddhist Order. And I think, again, that's very interesting. I still think there's some need for organisational structures that support that, because I do still believe that even just in a kind of practical sense, the sum, you know, can be greater than the part. The whole can be greater than the sum of the parts. And if you've got people working separately, that has a lot going for it. But those people uniting their energy can quite often actually maximise it to a great extent. But I think one has to be very congruent in what one does, and not just think that if you want to be an order member who's doing, you know, some kind of activity, that it needs to be through an established Buddhist centre. I love established Buddhist centres. I'm the chairwoman of an established Buddhist centre. I've spent my entire order life teaching in Buddhist centres. But I do also think it's crucial that there are other ways of teaching and other ways of moving out and other ways of relating to the world. You know, otherwise we end up running sort of institutes, don't we, rather than something alive and kind of really flourishing. So those are just some of my thoughts, really, from recently. I thought I'd just read you something from this Roads to Freedom, if I can find it, because I've lost my place. I found it, isn't that great? So this is Subbuti talking, and he's talking a little bit about the fact that he'd come from quite a radical, it's hard to believe sometimes, you know, but he did come from quite a radical kind of background. I say it's hard to believe because I think it's very easy to see Subbuti in a particular position at the moment, you know, and he often wears a suit. But don't let that fool you. Under that conservative exterior beats the heart of a true radical. So anyway, he talks quite a lot about his encounter with existentialism and politics. And then he says, when I came across Buddhism, I found a deeper version of that in the Bodhisattva ideal. I remember vividly the seminar that Banti led on the Bodhicaryavatara, that great poetic exposition of the Bodhisattva's way of life. The seminar had a huge impact on me. For one thing, it was the first time I really saw how a Buddhist text could contain a mysterious power and how well Banti could release that power for others. If you read the transcript of that seminar now, you might not think it very remarkable, because in the intervening years, these ideas have become a familiar part of our discourse. But in those days, they were dazzlingly new and revolutionary. It was tremendously exciting. But something else, even more important, that I experienced in that seminar was a sort of transformation of my sense of the relation between self and other. I had glimpses of an experience of self-transcendence. We who were participating seemed to be sitting together, not as so many discrete units of selfhood, adjacent in space, but as something more. While not ceasing to be individuals, we somehow shared the same consciousness. Fantastic. It's great, isn't it? And I can remember that. I remember having that feeling going to hear Banti give and take lectures. I mean, the Vimalakirti series, for example, was one of the series of tape, you know, lectures that I was actually present when Banti gave them. They were amazing. We'd this whole, it was in East West then, in East London, and it really did feel like you were transported to another world. And in fact, every week we got lost going back home. Every week. We drove around Trafalgar Square a number of times to get from East London to West London. You know, a route that we'd done 100 times, we got lost every week. And it was because somewhere, I mean, I do remember we ended up, you know, in Holloway Winds, which is a real detour. But it was like we had left this plane really hard. And actually, those of you who were at Banti's 1999 talk on the convention, when he talked about looking forward a little way, and he talked about universities, you know, cosmoses behind us, there was a point in that talk where my experience was very similar. I really was transported to another plane of existence. I really felt I was participating in something that was beyond myself, that was the third level, the third order of consciousness. I was not me, but I was not me. And it really was an amazing experience. You can see it in the video, it's not quite the same. There's something about being there. Well, we have to learn to do that without Banti now, you know. Probably we're not going to have that experience with Banti anymore. I mean, we might do. He might come and give talks. Who knows? But it's also possible that we won't. So I think we have to learn to create that kind of situation for ourselves. And of course that requires an incredible depth of individuality and an openness to something beyond our own individuality. And I believe we can do it. You know, I believe we can do it through working situations, through living situations. I believe we can just do it by listening to each other and being with each other. I also remember very strongly having that kind of experience on battle retreats, the LBC big open retreats, when I was part of a team for years, for I think 11 years, twice a year I was part of the team of those retreats. And there were a core number of people that did all those retreats. And we actually got to a way of being able to work with each other where you hardly had to speak. It really was electric. And it was a situation where your own needs were involved, because you couldn't run a retreat without being in touch with your own needs. But they were also at the service of something bigger than yourself. And it was ideal. It was fantastic. And I think we can create those sort of situations. I think we do create them. You know, I rejoice in the people who are here sitting here, because you are trying to do that. You're putting your money where your mouth is, and you're trying to create that kind of situation. So, you know, good on you. Let me just finish by asking some questions, which I'll leave you with. And as I said at the beginning, I don't have answers. All I wanted to do and all I've done is share with you some of my thinking. I hope some of it's been useful from the point of view of trying to be more individual and recognising the importance of collective. I don't think I've been able to really give quite as much, you know, there just isn't time or space to give how much I really love the collective aspect of things and how I don't think it's just an additional extra. I think it is actually crucial to the future of things and to the survival of things. You know, I really don't mean it's to see an order that becomes orders. that becomes something where there's so much self-reliance that we lose what gives the heart to that. So the questions that I would like to leave us with are, what conditions conduce to autonomy and self-reliance without creating insular or parochial situations? Yeah. So what conditions really allow for true autonomy in the sake of an institution or a part of an institution or team, a centre, whatever, without actually becoming parochial or insular? Okay, so in a way that's the centrifugal part of the question. The centripetal part of the question is, what conditions are needed to give real cohesion without giving away our spiritual authority or a psychological authority, a human authority, if you like? So I think those two questions go very well together, and they are to do with, well, how do we become an individual and be open to being part of a collective? You know, so I don't have answers. I'm very encouraged by the way we're doing that at the moment in the order. I'm sure you've heard, those of you who are not order members, have heard about the fora that we had in the mixed order convention, where we just had an open forum two mornings in a row where people could ask questions and talk and, you know, talk about their experience. And I think I would say that with two exceptions in those 5 hours, people managed to do that and really listen to each other and talk about their own experience. The two exceptions for me were when people didn't talk about their own experience and they talked about somebody else's experience in rather speculative kind of ways. But on the whole, in 5 hours, that's not bad. 15 minutes out of 5 hours, I think, is an acceptable level of, you know, failure. And I think that's part of a kind of healing process that really does need to happen, you know. It happened in the private preceptors meeting in April, probably even to a greater extent. It's a smaller meeting, people who know each other maybe better. And I think that kind of listening and that kind of speaking is really crucial. And I think it's crucial to becoming an individual. And I think it's crucial to creating collective listening and speaking. No? Shanti Deva says that all beings are a single body. So each part of that body needs to be healthy and needs to be in communication with the rest of the parts. We are an ecosystem, or an ecosystem, depending on how you pronounce it. You know, we all are. Wind horse evolution is an ecosystem that's got all its own kind of, you know, rainforests and its own kind of weather and its own kind of, you know, coming together. And I think unless we can all feel that the ecosystem that we're part of has space for us to grow in the manner that we want to grow, then we're going to wither up and die. And in the end, the ecosystem will wither up and die. So it's really crucial that we do learn to be individuals and that we do acknowledge our part in the collective, so that we can have a free flow of energy through mutual respect and listening. We can ask what is our common ground, and we can ask what is collective practice, and really, really look at those questions and not assume that we know the answers. And by doing that, perhaps we will create the conditions for what Banti called a non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy, which is the order and which is, at its best, all our ecosystems, all coming together to create one universal ecosystem. Thank you.